Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
You're listening to a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. If you want to listen to us in real time, you can stream our show live weekdays at 9 a.m. Central. Thanks for listening and enjoy the show.
Good morning, I'm Carrie Miller. This is NPR News. This hour, why planning for your death is more comforting than you think. My family has always been oddly open about the eventuality of our deaths. That meant conversations over dinner about funerals and care directors and trusts long before it was ever needed. Still, I've always known what my parents want when the time comes, and this book that we're talking about today came at just the right moment. Think about this. If you knew the hour of your death, you'd probably plan for it the way you've planned for other significant life events, a child's graduation from high school or college, your retirement day. And the reason that many of us don't plan is that trepidation of how we're getting to our deaths. Our guests write in a new book, Next to Birth, Death is One of Our Most Profound Experiences. Shouldn't we talk about it, prepare for it, use what it can teach us about how to live? As we begin the conversation, I'd like you to consider this. How much thought have you given to the details of what may precede and follow your death? Do you know what kind of care you want and don't want? Is this something that you've talked openly about with your parents or a partner or your children? So I'd like to know how detailed you've gotten in thinking about the way you want to die, what happens before and after. Is this the kind of conversation you can have in your family circle, that you can talk about this with your partner, with your children, with your parents? How do you come into these discussions with a lot of trepidation? I hope that we can allay some of that today. 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828, and on Twitter at CarrieNPR. Dr. B.J. Miller is a hospice and palliative care specialist at the University of California, San Francisco's Cancer Center, and he's with us from San Francisco. Dr. Miller, welcome. It's really good to have you on the show.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
Shoshana Berger is with us. She's a former senior editor at Wired Magazine and global editorial director at IDEO. And the book that she and BJ Miller have collaborated on is called A Beginner's Guide to the End, Practical Advice for Living Life and Facing Death. Shoshana, welcome. Good to have you on the show.
Thanks so much for having us.
And Dr. Miller, you're okay with BJ from here on in? Is that good?
That'd be great.
All right.
Preferable. Thanks.
Do you think what I said is true, that we shrink from the idea of planning for our death and arrangements after our death because it's the circumstances of getting to our death that is frightening, that kind of waves us away from this in a way that we, you know, that we plan for other life passages and have no trepidation about that?
Well, we know it's true, actually. I mean, we know most people think it's a good idea to plan for their death, as just as you're saying. And we also know that most people don't do it. So that's just a fact. Why that is, I think you're onto something. I think the fear of death is a deep, deep, deep one. And we keep inventing all sorts of spectacular ways to avoid the subject or at least distract ourselves from it. And usually that does come down to some amount of fear or trepidation, as you say, whether it's about the dying process or the mind bender of actually being dead. One way or another, it is can be a frightening, especially when unexamined, idea.
You know, Shoshana, I was thinking about how control comes into this. And I think we're going to hear from listeners today that the scary thing about this is feeling somewhat helpless about it and feeling out of control. I know it doesn't have to be that way, but I think that's how many of us come into the contemplation of what it's going to be like at the end. What can you add to that?
I think you're so right. And the fact is that we are out of control in many areas of life. You know, it kind of astonishes me how much time we spend preparing to bring new life into the world, which, of course, is another thing we're fairly out of control of. I mean, you can write an elaborate birth plan and read what to expect when you're expecting, but there is nothing for the other end of life, and we're woefully unprepared and end up in a crash course. But, of course, when you familiarize yourself with anything and get closer to it, it becomes less exotic and less scary and more knowable. And you get to feel like you have a little bit more agency and a little bit more control. Not total control, of course, but a bit more.
BJ, I really love what you and Shoshana wrote about what grief and denial are all about. I've never thought about it this way, but I've kept it in the back of my mind as my family goes through this right now. They all have to do with longing. That is so true. Longing for, you know, more time, right? Longing for maybe what could have been. It really helped me to think about this in a new way, and I'd love to hear how you'd contextualize it.
Well, I you're picking up on a favorite of mine, too, because I think, well, I think when you start including loss in general in the idea of grief, which I believe, I mean, loss is sort of a little cousin of death. I mean, we have losses all over the place. And I, you know, you kind of, once your eyes are open to it a little bit, I think most of us are in some amount of grief much of the time. It accounts for a lot of mood swings, a lot of sort of feeling surreal and out of place, et cetera. So it's a huge subject. And I think part of this conversation that's really another sort of underdeveloped piece of society. I really think if we got better at grieving, we'd be a kinder people, and we would also get to our death with a little less regret. Let me just sort of pick up on what you said. I think the key, you know, the mind's an amazing thing, and we can reframe things, we can recontextualize things, we can change how we see them. And what you're pointing to is one of my all-time favorites, which is the realization that we grieve because we love.
Right.
You know, that's a package deal. It's, you know, and so sometimes when you're feeling beset by grief, you know, it's really very helpful to realize the source of your feelings is actually love. And that makes it a little more approachable.
Yeah, Shoshana, I guess I was used to thinking of longing in a context of romance, right? When you can't have somebody you want or something happened to the relationship and you long for something different. But it is so true that the very source of grieving is because you have loved deeply. And I really think acknowledging that, even in the midst of a serious loss, helps a lot, right? It turns you back into what it means to be human than so focused on what is missing.
Oh, you've got that exactly right. I mean, BJ always talks about how grief and love are completely intertwined. You know, you can't have one without the other. And I think it's really useful to be able to think about your grief almost as a privilege of having been able to love
That's
that
right.
hard and that fiercely. And I, you know, I talked to a mother who was grieving losing her son, which is just devastating, as you might imagine. And she said to me, it was a real breakthrough for me at the bedside when I realized that all of my fear about letting him go was just the intensity of my love for him.
Mm-hmm.
And when I could see it that way, it really helped me.
Shoshana Berger with us, Dr. BJ Miller with us, if you've just gotten in on the conversation about their book, A Beginner's Guide to the End, Practical Advice for Living Life and Facing Death. But I want to say something here. We've had a number of conversations about this topic on the show, including how to put together a will and an estate, and you can find that on the show page. This book has compassion riding beneath all of the practical advice, too. So I don't want you to just think this is a step-by-step, here's what I do as I face the loss of a loved one. There's a lot of introspection here about what loss means and how to rise to that moment and be the person that your family needs you to be, and then how to contemplate your own life and your own death. 651-227-6000. I'm interested in whether you've given some contemplation to this, you've given some thought to this, what you want in what precedes and comes after your death. Are these conversations you feel ready to have with your parents or your children or a spouse or a partner? 800-242-2828, 651-227-6000, and on Twitter at CarrieNPR to Nancy in Bemidji. Hi, Nancy. Thanks so much for calling.
Hello.
Hi.
Yes, yes. After grandmother passed, we realized we didn't have some of her basic biological or biographical data. What grades did she teach in school? Whatever. So being a former teacher myself, we made a bare bones obituary form, and we put it on the cloud with access to everyone in the family. They filled in their own biographical data so we can pull it down at any time, no matter where we are, and have an instant obit. Folks also wrote what they'd like to have in a memorial service, quote, songs, whatever. So we're all ready. And, of course, we had to make it fun. We had a Valhalla party. People came dressed as casual Viking. And
celebrated
with games and launching a boat onto the lake.
So let me be clear. Like, you've circulated all the details within your immediate family about what people want at their memorial services. Is that right?
Exactly.
And everybody can access that. Wow.
Exactly.
That's a really good idea. Shoshana, have you heard about anything like that?
Wow. I really wish we had talked to you before we wrote this book. First of all, can I just say that I love that you hearkened back to your Viking past and sent that boat out. That's just amazing. I was just in Denmark, so it reminds me of the Vikings. I have to say that this is an incredible story, and the idea of using technology to enlist your family to collaborate on this kind of obituary and for have everyone compose it together is so amazing. I'm going to have to talk about your idea out on the road because I think it's brilliant. And it's true that, you know, we lose these stories. You know, you say you didn't know what grades she taught. And it's so often we don't capture the stories of our loved ones before it's too late. And so we do encourage people in the book to sit down with the people you love as they're getting older and capture their stories. Who were they? Where did they live as a kid? Who was their first crush? Those stories passed down from generation to generation are so powerful. They create a sense of continuity in families. They create a sense of legacy and purpose. And people often say that once they've done that, they feel better at the end of life. They feel better, not just psychologically, but actually in terms of well-being and health. It actually really shores people up.
BJ, I got the sense that you, in your work as a hospice and palliative care specialist, that you interact with families who have done what Nancy's described, but you also interact with families who have come to this moment having not given much thought to this and don't have the comfort of the kind of joy that you can take from, even in that moment of impending loss, from the celebration of the life that they're about to lose. Do a lot of families understand, I guess, how to put this together or shy away from it?
Well, you bring up a really important point here, and which is, no matter what you do, I mean, you can follow every step in our book and prepare as best you can, but that's still not going to make any of this easy. So I've worked with a lot of people who have done all their homework and are still, you know, and get to the end and still are gripped with fears and still struggle to find joy or beauty in this meaning, in this moment. And so I think, you know, and then there's also folks who have done no preparation at whatsoever and are just sort of in the moment and find themselves at the end and aren't really so concerned with the past or the future and do find themselves too. So I guess one thing to get across to your listeners here is we've laid out a lot of things that you can do, to ways to chip away at the pain, to make little space for the meaning and the love and the good stuff. But This is not, there's not a right or a wrong way to do this. Daily life is difficult enough. And, you know, you're going to find, most people find that they'll be wanting something at the end that they just can't have. Mm-hmm. And that's just fine. I mean, I think part of the subject requires us to let go of our goals and objectives at some point and just sort of be in the moment and be grateful for that moment that we have, that we can feel anything whatsoever.
Tell me what you mean when you say many people will want things that they just can't have at the end. Do you mean some kind of recovery from a terminal diagnosis or what?
Sure. Yeah, maybe it's cure that they're after, a cure of their illness that they're still after, they're holding out hope for. Perhaps it's the miracle of a reconciliation with an old friend or a family member. Mm. I think it's important to note that closure is an invention. We don't, you know, there is no, life keeps sort of barreling forward one way or another. And closure can be a gorgeous thing, but you have to understand it's something you need to create. You need to go tie up those loose ends. You need to find the narrative arc of your story that has a beginning, middle, and an end. That those aren't God-given. So closure is a beautiful thing, but just realize it's also an invention. You have to create it.
I really like the idea of that you creating your own narrative arc and then sharing that, right, with your mm-hmm. closest within the family.
That's right.
Here's how I see
yep.
the way my life was lived. It's good. Call here from Andy in Eagan. Hi, Andy. Thanks so much for waiting. Hi.
Hey, how's it going? That's all right. No problem. I think it's an important topic.
What are you thinking about in your own family and friend circle?
Well, so you know, I used to be a life insurance agent way back when I first started sales, you know, they said to me, you know, you're young now, and you know, maybe you might not have an emotional story yet that'll help you along the way, but at some point it'll happen. Well, it just happened on Tuesday. My wife's best friend's brother, if you can follow that, but we were really close with him. We had her brother and wife and kids over at our wedding, and you know, we were really close, mm-hmm. and they just moved out to Cold Spring. They're building this home, and on Tuesday he was working on this home, and you know, he's digging a trench for the well, and the ground collapsed on him, and it crushed him.
Yeah.
You know,
wow.
And it's like, what? You know, it just blows you out of your mind. So you know, I know it's a hard topic, but you know, if people haven't already. You know, it's just so important to do those, you know, easy, oftentimes free, you know, due diligent things, because I can tell you right now, you know, it's tough. It's tough.
You know, the other thing, Andy, is, I mean, just a minute ago, we talked about kind of the arc of the narrative of your life. I mean, nobody thinks, and my arc will stop at 42, you know, or whatever it is from some catastrophic accident. It's just not the kind of expectation that we have. BJ, I know you have some experience with this because you had a experience with mortality at an age when most of us think our deaths are years and years away. Could you speak to what Andy is saying, and then maybe we could talk a bit about what happened?
Sure, absolutely. Andy, you bring up a really important point. I think the sort of storybook side of death and dying is, oh, you have a long, fruitful life. You have your struggles. You have your triumphs. And then you retire. And then you slowly kind of come to terms with life outside yourself. And you're ready to move on. And it's sad, but it's glorious. And it's as God seemed to would want it. You know, that, sure, that does happen. But this subject is not just for older people. And it starts you thinking, I mean, when does anyone begin dying? I mean, it's actually a pretty profound, large question. And more and more, I in clinic and just by being on the planet, meet people like you, Andy, with friends and family who go, quote unquote, way too soon. Well, I think the too soon part really relates to how it's too soon because they're not prepared. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think this is a subject that a lot of us think should be taught, in grade school. And what is a long life? Is 20 years a long time? Is 100 years a long time? When is it, quote unquote, okay to die? When is it a tragedy to die? I mean, this is a very wide open question. So Andy points to this idea that the endless deferral of this subject matter because it's for older people. And that's just not true. And I'll say one more thing about that is not only would you potentially get caught unprepared, but what Shoshana and I have realized writing the book and a lot of my clinic patients will teach me is when you really dare to look death in the eye, or to the degree it's even possible, when you really sort of try to wrap your head around mortality, what you end up doing is you wrap your head around the preciousness of life and you start taking your time a little bit more seriously and not for granted. And that's a very beautiful side of this thing. That's, in other words, we're not just trying to make things less hard, but by turning your focus on this subject, you might find yourself loving life even more.
Is that how you think back to what happened? You were in college, weren't you?
Mm. Yeah, so for my situation, right, so 19 years old, I was a sophomore in college, just had a freak accident where I got close enough to a power line on top of a train, just horsing around, and I had a metal watch on, and the electricity arced to the watch, and so that was it. I ended up losing both legs and one arm and came very, very close to death. I mean, I could say part of me died. That's certainly how it felt, but that was the moment where I realized this death thing is not an abstraction, or it's not something in the future. It can happen, any moment, literally. And so I got close enough to be sort of forced to pay attention. And I will say, in the end, now years later, I'm actually very grateful for that excuse to pay attention to my life in this way. It served me very well.
Shoshana, what do you think of this grade school idea where you start to introduce the concept of mortality to kids who, I mean, if they're lucky, they've only lost a pet, at that point.
Right. Well, you'd be surprised how many kids experience this. Most kids by the time, I think it's 1 out of 7 kids by the time they're 17 have lost someone in their immediate family. Mm. So it's not a unique experience. And when we don't talk to kids about it, they assume the worst. And, we often try to protect kids, but they intuit more than you'd think. And so we actually have a mini book within the book called 8 Questions Kids Ask. And they ask the most interesting questions because they take everything so literally. Like, for example, I was mean to Grandpa last week and he died this week. Did I do that? Did I kill him? Or the euphemisms you use around death, grandma passed on or she went to a better place. And then that kid's sitting there thinking, well, why didn't she take me to that better place? there's all kinds of ways in which we have to learn to just follow a kid's lead. And we spoke to a wonderful life specialist who deals with these issues with kids. And she guided us through these questions that kids asked, and it was really eye-opening for us. And now I talk to my own kids in that way.
Dale says on Twitter, we just visited my 80-year-old mom this summer, and my 20-year-old son pulled out old photo albums and began asking her about her childhood and history. He recorded it all. Way to go. Wonderful experience. To the phones here to Kyle in White Bear Lake. Kyle, hi. Glad you waited. What'd you want to say?
Yeah, I had some loss over the last couple of years. Mm-hmm. And I think one thing that I found out was just the way the generations talk about death. My grandparents, my grandpa was like on his deathbed and he still didn't want to talk about it. And then my grandma had a lot of fear. And my parents are just, they don't really like talking about it very much, but they have plans in place. Whereas like me and my wife talk about it a fair amount. And I think the more you talk about it, like your guest said, you do kind of reevaluate where you're at and say, like, is this what I want to be doing with my life? And it helps you live a richer life,
yeah.
Which is something that I just don't see, some older generations doing is just like, you know, being involved in that conversation with death and how it can be a really beautiful thing.
You know, Kyle, I'm thinking as I listen to your different generational experience on this, proximity is a deal. I mean, Shoshana, maybe the closer you get to it, the less abstract it seems and the scarier it is. That said, I also hear Kyle saying, okay, as the millennial generation in the family, how can I introduce this topic in a way with beloved grandparents that doesn't reinforce the fear or the reluctance that they have to talk about it? Did you wrestle with that a bit in the book?
We did. And Kyle, I so appreciate what you've brought up. And I do think that this generation is more ready to have this conversation than our forebears, which is interesting because when you think about it, 100 years ago, people were dying around you all the time. I mean, you know, grandma might have died upstairs and, you know, on the farm, animals were dying all the time. And we had much more firsthand experience with it. So it's surprising in a way, and counterintuitive that that wasn't a conversation topic. But today I do think people are ready, and it does bring you a new sense of purpose. And the way to introduce it to people, I think, is tricky because there is a lot of fear around it. But what I've done with my own mother, who doesn't like to talk about it at all, is say, look, Mom, I've really thought through a lot of stuff about how I want to go. And I just want to share that with you. And I do. And then I say, you know, I'd love to hear how you feel about these things. What does quality of life mean to you? I mean, what are you willing to live without and with, and help guide me so that I can make sure that you have the best exit possible, because I want to be there for you.
Shoshana and BJ write, grief is a shapeshifter and it varies in intensity and form as it winds its way through a person. You can feel your insides wrestling with the loss, trying to reconcile the truth of what's gone with what remains. When confronted with death, grief may feel like a dream state, your mind and body a few steps behind the reality swirling around you. That's from the book, A Beginner's Guide to the End, Practical Advice for Living Life and Facing Death. Shoshana Berger, co-author, Dr. BJ Miller. And your calls and your experiences and the things that come up in your family and your circle of friends as you think about the end. 651-227-6000. If you get a busy signal, call us back. I want to hear from as many people as we can. 800-242-2828, wherever you are in the Midwest and listening. Are these conversations you feel prepared and indeed perhaps ready, eager to have within your family and within your circle of friends on Twitter at @CarrieNPR? We have a lot of calls to get to, BJ. I don't want to miss talking to you about this idea of creating an ethical will, because you talk about this as asking yourself about the values and the beliefs that you hold. Do you have one? What does it look like? How do you start this this idea?
I'm busted. I don't. I'm
glad you were honest with me. Okay.
Well, it's an important point, actually, in general. Like, you know, we have this when I die file that we sort of set out in the book as a way to sort of populate your file with all the important stuff. And, you know, hey, in fairness, a lot of us won't get to all of those things. We're all kind of just trudging our way. And Shoshana and I haven't completed ours either. But we're working on it. But so this is always a work in progress. And by the way, even if you have done all your paperwork, you need to revisit it because you think differently over time. Especially you think differently when you're walking around well, and you might think a little differently about your life when you're in a hospital and ill or close to the end. So these are all very, very dynamic conversations and to be having over time. So in a way, you're never kind of done. So back to your question about ethical wills. I mean, so it's an old and beautiful idea, and it's essentially, you named it, that it's a way to, pass on. So you have wills and things to sort of pass on your stuff, but an ethical will is a way to sort of pass on your persona, you know, how to let folks in your family or whoever else know about who you were, what you thought, how the experience you've had, for sure, sort of chronicling like we've already discussed. But beyond sort of chronicling of facts of your life, it's also about your opinions on life. What have you right. learned? What wisdom have you acquired? What questions have you left unanswered? What mysteries do you still look to? How do you find inspiration in life? These are obviously hugely beautiful and powerful sort of tales, but those are hard to pass on. It's almost like an oral tradition. So there is this thing to note called an ethical will, which is a way to document this side of your persona. And we should thank a man in your home state there, mm-hmm. Mr. Baines, who we interviewed for the book, who does ethical wills there in Minnesota. And so there are folks out there who can help you work through an ethical will. It's something of a template for this.
Shoshana, you know what I like about this is I think many of us believe that our ethics and our values are expressed through our philanthropy, right? And that continues right up into the estate, the organizations that you are giving money to. But I feel like a statement of the things that you held as high principles is really important context for the decisions that you make about how you are dispersing your estate. Does that make sense?
Absolutely, it does. And I just want to give Dr. Barry Baines a proper plug. He's in Minneapolis, and he has reinvigorated this movement to write ethical wills, which dates back to biblical times. But what you say is so important. The idea that you write a will and it's one and done and you can just put it in a drawer is really not that effective for people, your kids who are going to read that will, and they might question some of your decisions. So part of the work of an ethical will is explaining why you made those decisions. So, you know, maybe you gave the condo in Florida to the youngest sister instead of the eldest, and the eldest is wondering, why did that happen? And you explain, well, you know, you already had a condo in Florida, so we wanted to give it to Jenny. So, you know, there are things that you can convey in an ethical will that will really help your family understand why you made the decisions you did. And also just passing down your values. So we say, you know, a will is to pass down your value, and an ethical will passes down your values. Who were you as a family? What are the things that you learned from your parents that you want to pass down? We heard a gorgeous story about a man who had really made a lot of money during his lifetime, and he came from a very poor past, so he really raised himself up. And he wrote an ethical will to explain to his kids why they were going to get a lump sum of money when they were 21. He said, you know, you're going to inherit this big sum of money, and I want you to know where that came from. This wasn't always here, and it's partly based on, you know, what we value as a family, which is hard work.
To the phones to Zach in Minneapolis. Hi, Zach. Thank you so much for waiting. I'm really glad you did. Tell us a little bit about yourself.
Yeah, I'm so delighted that BJ and Shoshana's book has come out. It's a beautiful piece of work. Thank you guys for everything that's in it. So I'm a hospital chaplain, and I keep seeing the suffering that happens at end of life and after end of life when people haven't had these kind of conversations or didn't have them with the right people or didn't write them down. So I just want to tie into what Shoshana was saying about the explaining why. I actually interviewed BJ for the national nonprofit that we launched here in Minnesota that helps people have these really hard conversations. And one of the really big things we focus on is not just what you want or don't want, but why. Because it turns out we can't always honor somebody's wishes, but we can always honor the values behind those wishes.
That's right.
I remember being with a family. The dad was really clear that he was like, hey, if I'm even close to death, go ahead and pull the plug. And I was facilitating the conversation with his daughter who lives abroad. And she said, Dad, couldn't we maybe just keep you on machines long enough for me to come home? He had never thought about that. And he actually made a 180-degree turn because she told him why that would make a difference. So
Yeah. Our
nonprofit is here in Minnesota. We're called Alay Care. And our website's alaycare.org. And we are using BJ and Shoshana's book because it's super, super helpful for helping people have those conversations.
BJ, I think I'm recalling a couple that you both talked to where the husband was very straightforward about this, and the wife said, but do you know how painful some of those decisions would be for me? and he changed his mind, I guess. Do I remember this right?
You do. First of all, thanks a lot so much. It's nice to hear your voice again, Bud, and congratulations on your good work, and thanks for helping us with the book. But let's see. So back to your question. So yes, so you're referring to a story in our book which gets at this. It's actually the story of a colleague of mine at UCSF, a woman named Rebecca Sidori, who ironically sort of makes it, her research is all about documenting people, you know, making sure you communicate your wishes about
right.
the end of life.
That's right.
So she's referring to her own family, and it's this beautiful story. I mean, so she's talking to her grandparents, and again, she's a professional, like the professional in this. So she's talking to her grandparents. Her dad, her grandfather's is not doing so well physically and maybe nearing the end, and she's asking him what he wants for himself at the end of life and wants from his care and going through all the good questions. And, you know, he said, right, when it's my time, it's my time. I don't want to prolong this. I've had a good life. When it's my time, let me go. In other words, let nature take its course, essentially. And so Rebecca turns to her grandmother and says, Grandma, did you hear what he said? How do you feel about that? Just want to make sure you're hearing him. And she said, well, that's great, but no, I want every millisecond I can have with this man. So if that means machines, then so be it. And so Rebecca, trying to, referee this match, turns back to grandfather, and she said, well, did you hear what grandma said? And, you know, what should we do here? And he said, he said, basically, then keep me on machines, essentially. You know,
That really surprised me, you know, that he was going to die in a way that felt maybe difficult for him, but that he was, that it was really all about what it was going to be like for her. Yeah.
Yes. This idea of autonomy, that any of us sort of exists in a vacuum, that we are these independent critters walking around, it's just not accurate. Mm-hmm. We're all social creatures, and many of us, depending on our relationships, are much more concerned with our loved one than ourselves. And so for him, the thing that trumped his own wishes were hers.
Stephanie says on Twitter, my brother suddenly died at the age of 47. Half the family wants the conversation of the future. The others walk out of the room when we start talking about it. I've had everything planned, will and funeral for myself for many years, and I'm only 38. Diane called to say, my mother died 20 years ago. She made it clear that if she got ill or could no longer contribute, she wanted us to let her go. She got to that point. We had to make the decision. And we did. We found a newspaper clipping of a woman in a coma that she'd hid in a box on top, and there was a note saying, let me go. We knew we'd done the right thing. To Patrick in Minneapolis. Hi, Patrick.
Hello.
Hi.
Thank you for taking my call.
I'm glad you called.
When you mentioned about dying, I'm 80 years old. I would like to, what I say, we're out of control with allowing a person to have death with dignity, and I think you grieve a lot less when you have had a dear loved one pass in peace rapidly, like a heart attack, instead of having somebody on machines. I visit people in Alzheimer's wards. They were friends of mine for 50 years. They would die knowing that they are per se being kept alive, and they are totally dead mentally.
Yeah.
And why can't we have what I would call when you write out your will, that people cannot interfere with it or challenge it or fight it, because I've seen this happen over and over again.
Patrick, if I might, we don't have much time left, but you're raising some really profound questions here. Shoshana, will you address this, and then Dr. Miller can weigh in?
I sure will. Patrick, I really resonate with what you're saying. My own father died with dementia and suffered with it for over 5 years. And as a caretaker to him, it was so painful for me to see him lose the one faculty that mattered most to him. He was a professor for 50 years. He was basically a walking brain. And when he lost that, he really lost quality of life. And seeing him, you know, go back and forth from the hospital and regress every time and end up in nursing homes was just torture for my sister and I. And part of the reason why I wrote this book with BJ is because I had a lot of regret about that, and I really wanted to redeem that experience by giving people a sense of what they can do to avoid that fate. And it's not always possible, but, you know, you can write some pretty specific instructions for what you want should that happen to you. And I indeed have done that in my own advanced healthcare directive, just written to my family, listen, if I can't recognize you and I can't eat a bagel and I can't, you know, do many things by myself, I would like for you to let me have a natural death. And what that means is if I pick up some little virus or flu or pneumonia, please just allow that to progress and don't give me antibiotics if I'm at that point where I can't recognize you or the world. But people don't know that they can do such things.
That's right.
And it's so important that you understand there is something of a stepwise approach that the healthcare industry will recognize if you do that in advance.
BJ, just a note here. Often, does that mean a pretty clear conversation with the care team?
You got it. Thank you. That's sort of the crux here. Amen to the caller, Patrick. Thank you very much. I mean, but let's also be clear, dignity means different things to different people. So for some folks, dignity may be, you know, all guns blazing in the ICU with chemo hanging, you name it. So the point here is for you to name what's dignified to you and then that you communicate that. And so to your point, Carrie, that one of the probably the most, from a tactical point of view, probably the most important thing to do to protect your wishes is to name your healthcare proxy. The durable power of attorney for healthcare is another way of putting this, or your agent. Naming that person and staying in touch with that person means you've deputized someone to speak on your behalf if you can no longer do so, and someone to advocate for your wishes. So yes, communicate with your care team, with your doctor, write down your wishes, absolutely. But if I had to pick one thing to do, it would be to name your proxy and stay really close contact with that one person so they can advocate for you.
And we have done that with someone in our family. Is it usually someone in your family?
Not necessarily. I mean, it typically is. But one thing to get clear is this is not an honorific. It can kind of feel like I've asked you to be my agent, therefore you are speaking on my behalf. I mean, there is an honor to it.
And a weight.
It's a big job. Yeah, and a responsibility. That's right. And so the person, like back to Rebecca's grandparents, it may be the case that the grandma was not necessarily the best proxy because she said she was not going to be able to put his wishes above her own. She wasn't going to be able to get out of the way of her own emotion. And that's very hard for someone very close in to do. So sometimes it's a spouse, sometimes it's a kid, but you need to name someone who's going to be really able to put themselves aside and speak for you.
I don't want to miss talking about what you say about a terminal diagnosis and how it can be valuable to sit down and create three columns on a piece of paper: my situation, my goals, trade-offs. I think I understand the situation and the goals. Talk to me a bit about the trade-offs. What are you coming to terms with in that column?
Well, it often comes down to treatment. So very, very often, so for your listeners, just set the table here for a quick second. Most of us these days are going to die from a chronic illness. Mm-hmm. In other words, we're going to have the diagnosis that we're going to know the thing that's going to take our life someday, and it'll usually be months or years down the road. We will live with the thing that will kill us often for years. So you have to kind of enter in some relationship with it. But this also means that one way or another, depending on how you feel about the medical system and healthcare in general, you can opt out of a lot of it. There's good reason to do so sometimes. But one way or another, you're going to be affected by treatment choices. And so where these trade-offs come in are most, at least in my experience, where I spend the most time sort of wading through them with people, is in this medical medical moment. Do I take this next treatment? Do I get a pacemaker? Do I take that next round of chemo? Mm-hmm. Whatever it is. And one thing to just get clear is every single decision you're going to be making in this space is going to be fraught with trade-offs. There's no such thing as something that's all good for you or something that's all bad for you. It's all contextualized. So it's very relative. So when you're having conversations with yourself, your loved ones, and your clinicians, not only do you have to talk about the treatment you might be choosing, but you also have to talk about what happens if I don't take that treatment? What are my options? And if you have a full conversation like that, it's interesting. A lot of people, when they have a full-throated, well-supported conversation where the truth is laid out for them, will often choose to not treat their illness, and that's just fine.
Wow. Dr. B.J. Miller, Shoshana Berger, the authors of A Beginner's Guide to the End, Practical Advice for Living Life and Facing Death. Thank you so much, both of you, for spending the hour with us. Really valuable information. Thank you.
Thank you, Carrie.
Thank you, Carrie, so much, and your listeners, too.
I want to let you know we've put our show on Wills and Directives onto the podcast stream and on the show page. It is easily accessible. You'll hear at the beginning of that show that I said that I had not created a will. I did after that show, and I hope you will too.
You just heard a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. To add your voice to the discussion, you can call in at 800-242-2828 or tweet us at @CarrieNPR. And if you miss us live, you'll find all our shows by subscribing to this podcast. You can send us your questions or comments by emailing talk@npr.org.